We're very privileged today to have David Elkind, who is professor emeritus at Tufts University and the author of more than a dozen books. His groundbreaking books, The Hurried Child and Miseducation, informed early childhood education professionals of the possible dangers of pushing down the elementary curriculum into the very early years of a child's life. He also wrote Ties That Stress, The New Family Imbalance, All Grown Up and No Place to Go, and Reinventing Childhood. He is a consultant to schools, mental health associations, and private foundations. Dr. Elkind is a champion for developmentally appropriate instructional and learning practices and the importance of play. He lives outside of Boston and on Cape Cod. We are very proud to have him present at our annual colloquium. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to David Elkind.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I'd like to begin, if I may, with a story that a teacher told me recently, a first grade teacher, of a young man who was coming into her first grade class from half-day kindergarten. And he'd been in a lot of programs. He'd been in traveling t-ball. He'd been in karate. Had some plays, some in soccer, had been into some music lessons, Suzuki, and his mother was thinking of giving him some ballet to sort of round out his resume. And it was the first day of full day first grade, and the noon bell rang, and he was used to going home, so he put his little backpack on, walked to the door, waiting to be dismissed. And the teacher, recognizing his error, walked over to him and said, "You know, Tim, you're a big boy now. You're in first grade. You get to stay the whole day." And he looked up at her and he said, "Who the hell signed me up for this?" One of our Ogre program children, when I first began talking about, about hurried children more than 25 years ago, I was concerned with school-age children primarily and early childhood, but it's gone much earlier than that now. There is now a prenatal university, PNU, in California, of course, and the curriculum involves reading Shakespeare to the fetus in utero, playing Mozart, and in case you have a low voice, they've invented a device which is called the pregaphone. Now, I don't know if you've seen this, but to me it looks like a large plastic plunger attached to by a plastic hose to a small plastic plunger. Mother puts a large plastic plunger on her stomach, talks to the baby through the small plastic plunger. 1595 Santa Barbara, California. Comes in a variety of colors. And it would be funny if it weren't sad that we're doing all this kind of pressure. And this is part of what technology has done, is pushed all these things down to kids. Now there is a so-called lapware for 6 months to 2 months, two-year-old children. The baby sits on the parent's lap and pushes a mouse-like, mushroom-like mouse. And supposedly, the infant can learn colors and a variety of other things through this. Unfortunately, a lot of these programs don't know anything about child development. For example, infants know their colors by 4 months and already prefer red, so that, you know, they don't need a computer to teach them colors. Anyway, but I think in a lot of these programs, a lot of the things are, they promise a lot of stuff that there's simply no evidence for. It's going to help the child's, develop the child's self-esteem. Well, children don't have a concept of self until really two or three, and that's very beginning concepts of self. So the idea that these programs are going to do that, and there are many others, whether it's the Baby Einstein and so on. And Baby Einstein is, I think if you're a busy parent, you need the baby to be quiet for a little while, and babies like the baby Einstein may not do any harm, but too often they become babysitters. And one of the problems with some of the technology is that, for example, television, that we operate according to a law of least effort. We try to do things which are easiest for us. And vision is easier than hearing. And when children sort of watch things, if they see television, if they get all the information from watching, they don't listen. And one of the consequences is that children who watch too much television don't develop their auditory discrimination skills. Now, reading is not only a visual skill, it's an auditory discrimination skill. Obviously, you have to hear sounds and know it. And for example, you'll find that one of the reasons you have difficulty reading a book like the Russian novels and so on is because the names are so difficult. The reason is that we unconsciously try to say the name in our heads, so when we find names that are difficult, it helds us our reading. And that's just to say that reading is an auditory and not just a visual thing. And so when children spend too much time on the visual media, they become sort of adapted to the visual and try to get all their information visually and don't develop the auditory discrimination skills. That's just one aspect of this, the problems that we have with new technology. There are many advantages to new technology, but there are many disadvantages. So I want to talk about a few of those. One of the things that I think has happened is that we have begun to think of children in technical ways, and children think of themselves in technical ways. In our children's school at Tufts, one young man was of three was sitting on the potty and not having much success, and after a while, 10 minutes or so, he said, "I guess I need new batteries." So we begin to think of ourselves in physical terms, and we begin to, it really troubles me when I hear that even teenage girls are now having plastic surgery and so on, that we can modify our bodies, we can do all these things, and we're almost like objects. So again, some of the pressures that we have, and we as parents begin to think of children differently as well, thanks to technology. We begin to think of children as much more malleable. There are really three ways that we think about children. One is that children are all good, and that it is society which corrupts them, the Rousseauian kind of idea that society corrupts. Children are really basically good, have their own ways of knowing and learning. And the other is that children are basically bad, the sort of Puritan notion that we're born with original sin, as Cotton Mather said, "You're never too young to go to hell." You know, so that he intoned. And then there's the third, which is that children are blank slates, and and this is the Watsonian notion that you can raise any child to be a doctor, baker, criminal, butcher, baker, butterman, thief. And that's the kind of thinking that I think has, you know, some of the technology. That's Watson really started with his behaviorism and conditioning and so on, and believing that you can teach any child anything at any time in a responsible way, as Jerry Bruner said. And so we've begun to push everything down on young children. We begin to teach, not only the visual stuff, but everything. My granddaughter, who just visited, knows all the Disney characters, and my grandnieces know all the Disney characters. They know all the Disney books. They know all the songs. But when I took my granddaughter to the beach, and she lives in Hawaii, my son lives in Hawaii, but she's in so many activities, she loved the beach. She doesn't go to the beach. This is Hawaii, and Honolulu, and Waikiki, and all that, and Waikia. So, I think childhood in many ways, thanks to technology, has moved indoors. Children spend more time watching television, playing television games, and so on, and they're not experiencing the real world, and I think it's one of the Frederick Froebel, the inventor of the kindergarten, said something that I wish we could post on every parent of young children's refrigerator. He said, Children need to learn the language of things before they learn the language of words. Children need to learn the language of things before they learn the language of words. Children need to learn about, and there's no other way that children are not born knowing about the difference between hard and soft, red and green, smooth and hard, sweet and sour. Children can only learn those things by active exploration. They're not inborn, and it takes time and effort to do that. And I talked at my granddaughter's school, and my son said to me, "I know, Dad, that you said, you know, kids need to dawdle. That's the way they learn. They need to explore things and so on. But I just don't have time. I have to get to work. I have to get her in the car to take her," you know. And I think that that's so true for so many parents today, that they know what really is good for kids. They know that dawdling, the children need to explore the world. Everything is new to them. That's one of the reasons that children like to hear stories again and again and again. It's not just repetition for the child. It's new, and each time he or she hears the story, they discover something new, if it's only the way in which we read it and the intonations we make. But the words and the pictures, there's so much that we miss because we don't notice all the little details that they're looking at in the pictures or the intonations they're hearing. So for them, each time we read the story again, it's a learning experience. And when children dawdle and they stop to look at something long, it's because the world is so new to them. It's like when we go to a new country, you know, no matter how many television sectors or pictures we've seen, if we go there, the sounds, the smells, the sights are so new, and that we need to take some time to experience them, and that we and that's what really stays with us, why we remember those things so intensely when because they're new. We remember those fresh experiences. So again, what I think is happening, unfortunately, is that we're children are, there's plenty, I'm not to say that you know, the real world is, the virtual world isn't important. Certainly it is. But, you know, Bill Gates didn't grow up with computers, and Stephen Jobs didn't grow up with computers, and they seem to have done all right. So the idea that you have to have these things early in life, just computers have no place in the crib. That's the all. And I think one of the things that troubles me is that for children today, the boundaries between the real world and the virtual world have become so much more permeable. It's hard for them sometimes to know which is, and children, the way technology has changed the way children think about the world as well. If you realize it, you know, in many ways, time, for example, has become reversible. Now you have instant feedback. You can play something over and over again. You can see pictures of yourself, and you almost reverse time, but also it can be very fast. It's almost instantaneous. You can do these things so quickly, and space has become portable. You know, we can now see, and you know, if you're going to travel, you can go and look at the hotel room you're going to sit in and see all different kinds of the place, or you can visit all over the world. And now certainly with high definition television. And some of it is wonderful. Some of the nature studies you're seeing about how bees and animals live and so on, it can be fantastic. But it also means that space has become much more portable. We can bring it right into our living rooms. And even more so, causality, these basic categories of knowing that Kant talked about, of space and time and causality, that we all have. But how we interpret those and how we understand those depend a lot upon the environment we're growing up in. And causality has become magical, because now children push a button and things happen, and they have no idea how those things happen, what makes the thing happen. When you push a button and all of a sudden the baby talks, or you turn on the television and you see this picture and so on, there's no way for the child to understand the relationship between what they're doing and what happens on the screen, and it's all like magic. Whereas earlier, a lot of the toys children used, even if it was a toy typewriter, they could see the impact of their finger and what was effect having, or you built something and you saw the cause of it, and so on. But today, everything is so technologically, you know, complex, that it's very difficult for children, even young children particularly, to understand how one thing leads to another. So all of these things, I think, have implications for children. For example, the fact that everything is so fast now, I think children have become more impatient. We're, you know, we've always been a hurrying society, but the fact that everything happens so quickly now, children want it instantly because everything happens instantly, so it's got to be right there, right now. you don't want to wait. And I think because children have this sense of magical causality, it in many ways kills curiosity. If there's no way that you can figure out what's going on, you don't even try to figure it out anymore. And one of the consequences of all of these things, and why I wrote the book on play, was that one of the consequences is that somehow parents and now children too begin to think that play is somehow a waste of time, and play is a luxury we can't afford anymore. At one time, play was seen as a defining characteristic of childhood, but now is it seen as a waste of time? I was observing in our children's school at Tufts, and a mother came in and she made a face, and I said, "Why are you making a face?" Well, she said, she looked at some children at the gallery, and they were playing. She said, "They're playing." And I said, "What's wrong with that?" She said, well, you know, my son's friend goes to another police school, and they're learning their numbers and letters, and here they're just playing, they're wasting, he's going to fall behind, and so on. And it's hard to explain to parents how important play is to young children, and that all those technological things are really not what are appropriate for young children. Play really is a way in which children learn. Freud was once asked, do you need to live a full and successful and happy life? And he said, "Leben und arbeiten, loving and working." But if you ask Jean Piaget, the famed Swiss psychologist, he would probably say assimilation, accommodation, assimilation and accommodation, or working and playing. And if you combine those two great thinkers and great psychologists, you have the formula for a successful, happy life is play, love, and work. That is, their play, love, and work. Play and work, although they are opposite, often sort of contrasted, are really complementary. Work is the way in which we adapt ourselves to the demands of the world. Play is the way in which we adapt the world to our own needs and demands. And both are necessary and both are important. And play is one of the ways in which we learn. Psychologists talk about learning or work as the modification of behavior as the result of experience. The modification of behavior as a result of experience, conditioning, and so on. Play is the modification of experience as the result of behavior. The modification of experience is the result of behavior. Through play, children create new learning experiences. And that's what's so important about play. It's through play that children create experiences that they couldn't have in any other way. Consider the baby who babbles. No one teaches the baby to babble. It's a kind of play, repetitive play. But through that babbling, the child learns all of the words, that all of the sounds that he or she needs to speak their native language. And from those words, every infant around the world presents all those sounds that are needed for any language around the world. But the child selectively, from listening to the parents and so on, selects those sounds which he or she needs. So only through play can children learn to speak. And certainly when children begin to play in dramatic play in preschool and so on, they learn a lot of things that they can only learn through play. And I call that kind of kinship play, where they learn some children are leaders, some children are followers, some children are outgoing, some children are not, some children are mean, some children are kind. You don't learn that in a computer. You learn that through social interaction with other children. When children play board games, they learn strategies to read body language, they learn vocal intonations, they learn strategies of play and so on, which you can't learn in a computer game. And so all of these things are things that children do learn. But it's not just the social things that children learn through play, it's the academic things as well, and particularly for young children. I think the physical exploration of the real world really gives them the basics for really math, science, and we forget that the basic unit of science and basic unit of reading and math is really the unit concept that's basic to all later formal education. Young children don't have a notion of a unit. We can take number for example. Children start with a number of nominal number. They start with the idea that two or three children know number will be like the number on a football jersey or a baseball jersey. It's not really a name. It's just a number that stands for a name. So if you're a basketball fan, 33 is Larry Bird's number, and so on. And so children can understand that kind of thing. A number is a kind of nominal way. And then by 3 or 4, they get to know number as a kind of ordinal stage. It's what we do when we rank things. For example, you rank cakes at a cake sale, or you ice skating is a good example. We give ice skaters ranks of 6 or 5 or whatever. But those numbers really don't stand for units. There are no units of ice skating. As a matter of fact, the same is true for grades in school, A, B, and C. There are no units of grades. I try to tell the parents and teachers all that. The B is not twice a C, and A is not 3 times an A. And, I mean, they're very subjective rankings, really, that have no unit quantities. And intelligence tests, unfortunately, are the same way. We have units of intelligence, but you really can't use them. A child of 100 IQ is not doesn't have twice the intelligence of somebody with a 50 IQ intelligence test. Those are arbitrary units, not real units. And so children can rank, and they can put, for example, they can stack a pile of things from largest, next largest, next. So that's an ordinal ranking kind of thing. They're units, but they can rank them. And it's only when they develop the new mental abilities that the ancients called the age of reason, and that Jean Piaget called concrete operations, which come about at the age of 6 or 7. We now have new brain research tells us that many of the stages that Piaget talked about are now confirmed by changes in the brain at those stages. And so we know that the fundamental shift comes about at that time. And up until that time, children are able to understand certain, for example, one thing can be one thing. They can, it's a very concrete kind of thing. They, for example, in reading, they can understand that, an A is an ah, and they can understand that. Cat, hat, so on, they can do that. And even with respect to stories, children's stories, for example, fairy tales and so on, are unique in that they're one-dimensional. In the fairy tale, they're the wicked godmother, or the fairy prince, the Prince Charming. People are all good or all bad. Goldilocks was a bad little girl, and so on. And even if we work with young children as teachers and so on, and they sometimes meet us in the supermarket, they don't recognize us because you can't be a teacher and a person at the same time. You can't be two things at once. And even parents sometimes get that experience when they sort of dress up and not do the usual kind of things. So, but that's not right or wrong. It's simply that's the way that young children think. They can't recognize that one thing can be two things at once. That takes those new mental operations. It really is syllogistic reasoning. It's why they called the ancients called it the age of reason. It's the Aristotelian notion that all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. But it's the same sort of thing that in order to understand rules, which involves all formal education, you have to have that kind of reasoning. For example, when two vowels go walking, the first one does the talking. Here in this thing, the first vowel is A, so it's R. But that is the same thing. What you have to realize then is that one thing can be two things at the same time, and that's what that kind of reasoning allows you to do. It allows you to see that Socrates is both man and mortal. And all children get those abilities. Some children get them at 4, some get at 5, sometimes get at 6, some get them at 7. They all get them because we're biological beings. We all get them. Some retarded children may never go as far, but children get them at different ages because we are biological beings and we grow at different paces, and that has nothing to do with IQ. It has something to do with the fact that some children, it's like very much like early adolescence. Some children attain puberty at 11, some at 12, some at 13, some at 14, some at 15. They all attain puberty, but they do it at different ages because we're biological beings and we have different heredities and different genes and so on. And the same, but We somehow, in our wisdom, believe that because a child is five, he should be there or she should be there. But that isn't true. Not all five-year-olds are where they, you know, have these operations. Some may have them, some others may not. And so when we try to gear our curriculum or gear our teaching or try to the child's age, we make a big mistake in early childhood, because early childhood is very much like early adolescence. Children get these abilities at very different ages. If you take a five-year-old who isn't there yet, who hasn't yet got these concrete operations, and you try to teach him phonics, for example, the child, you try to say, child knows A, for example, and he knows hat and cat and sat, no problem, because of one letter, one sound, great. The teacher suddenly confronts him with eight, and he shakes his head. I mean, I know hat, I know cat, but I don't know this. I don't know, I can't understand this. And, you know, children before this age of concrete operations, we as adults are all wise, all, you know, knowing beings. We created the earth and so on. And so when a child, the teacher says to the child, he should understand this, you know, you should understand this word, you should be able to read it. The child says, well, I can't read it, I can't figure it out, but this all wise, all knowing, wonderful person here tells me I should know this. But I can't figure it out. So it must be me, I must be dumb. Ladies and gentlemen, we send all too many children to school only to learn they're too dumb to be there. Why? Because we're retaining across the country in our public schools and kindergartens some 30-50% of children in some communities. Why? Because we're trying to teach them things which are inappropriate to teach them. And what we the consequence is that we have too many children who are, feel that they're flops in life. You know, if a child comes out of educational program of the 5, 6, 7 in a program where he or she likes school, likes teachers, enjoys learning, then that's very hard to turn around later. But if you take a child at that age and because of these kinds of experience, a child hates school, hates teachers, dislikes learning, that's very hard to turn around too. And so important for us to give children a healthy early childhood education. That's why programs such as the one here at the library are so good for children, because they're age appropriate. They're not asking children to do things that they can't do. And you know, technology is great, but we can't change nature, and children are not growing up any faster. You know, Sesame Street's been on for more than 30 years, and children still aren't reading any earlier than they did 30 years ago. Anyways, they're probably learning reading better. And so they probably wrote better at that time. So again, technology is one, there are many positive things about technology, but when it's pushed down into early childhood, we can do a lot of harm to children because we're asking them to do things which they're really not able to do. In fact, there are only really three things which young children need to do to succeed in first grade, and it doesn't have to do really with knowing their letters and their numbers, which is why what children are expected to do today and why so many are being held back. There are three things that children need to know, and first is to be able to listen to an adult and to follow instructions. Second is to be able to start a task and complete it on his or her own. And the third is to work cooperatively with other children, to learn to take turns, to stand in line, and so on. If children have those social skills, they have the social skills. The numbers, the letters, other things come easily. Children want to learn. They want to learn those things. But they require, you know, the social skills really are the prerequisite to that kind of learning. So I think one of the problems with the technology is that we begin to see children as much more malleable. Glenn Doman says, you know, children are, every child's a Leonardo da Vinci, and you can show them flashcards, and, you know, you can begin, and the kindergarten has become a downsized first grade. It doesn't really make any sense. We don't teach, for example, the college curriculum at the at the high school level. We may have some advanced placement courses, but we don't translate the college into the high school. We don't teach the high school curriculum at the junior high, and we don't teach the junior high curriculum at the elementary level. So why should we teach the elementary curriculum at the preschool? It's exactly the same thing. Each of those curriculum are adapted to where children are developmentally. And now suddenly we ignore all of that, and we want to push this down in early childhood. And so when we do that, we do more harm than we do good. Certainly children are varied and so on, and certainly children benefit a great deal from interaction and so on, and from being read to, and some children may be, by three or four, may be able to get on the computer and do some things, as long as they're primarily graphic and not verbal. But it should be a very small part of the child's experience, because I think one of the things that I talk about in play is that play, love, and work, that they work together and they're present throughout life, but that during early childhood, play is the dominant, so that whenever we combine play and love work, we have the best possibility. And in early childhood, children know what they need to learn, and play is that they choose the kinds of things they want to learn, and if they're allowed to do that, then that's enjoyable for them, and they respect the people who are allowing them to do that, teachers and parents and so on. And as a result, you have a combination of play, which is a child's own initiative, it comes from the child. You have work, which is the learning that comes as a result of that, and you have love, which is the respect that the child has for those who allow him or her to learn in that way. And that's true in the home as well. When we listen to children, we take the time to listen what they have to say, respect their point of view and so on, then they're more willing to learn what we have to teach them. So when we take their point of view, which is the play aspect, their niche, and listen to them, then they're more willing to listen to us and learn the kinds of things we want to teach them, and there's more respect and love between us. So when you bring play, love, and work together, you have the most effective results. Play and work, instead of trying to sort of separate them and see them as opposed to one another. Montessori said play is the child's work, and what she meant was play is the way in which children learn, but it got very confused, and parents now think, well, children shouldn't be playing, they should be working. But play and work are very different, and they're complementary, and we need both. And even in the workplace, if you're a worker and you're respected and your input, if you make suggestions and so on, those are valued and rewarded, you're going to be a better worker. And the result is going to be, the product is going to be better, and you're going to be respected like your employer. It's not rocket science when companies in which they employ this kind of culture are much more effective. So but in early childhood, play, becomes the dominant means of we should really need to follow children's lead, because they know what they need to learn. And if we follow that lead, children are going to respect us, and they learn more. Even infants, it always troubles me when an infant is looking at something or playing with something, and the parent gets bored and give them something else, another toy. Well, you don't want to play with that anymore. It's not the child who's bored, it's the parent's bored. The child is learning a great deal, and it's amazing how even young children, before the age of one, can be very concentrated and spend a great deal on a particular thing, because they're learning so much. It may be boring for us. We forget that these are new for children, and we always want to go in and pose on children. And I always say, watch what the child is looking at, watch what the child is doing. And even with my teachers in training, often I'll see a child's playing with something, say a water wheel, and turning it over, pouring water on it, making it turn again and again and again and again, and the teacher gets bored and wants to do something else. But the child is learning, and that's his way of learning, and you have to follow the child's lead. At this stage, children really need to know, and so providing them with toys which they can, that was Montessori's genius. She founded materials which were, she called, self-didactic, and a board with a lot of holes in it with metal cylinders of different sizes, and children would put them in, but they would have to find out by trial and error which ones went in there, and they could get, she found one little girl who was playing with this thing, and she picked her up, put her on a table, picked the table up, had the children march around and sing, and this child still kept playing, and when she was done, she had this great satisfied look on her face, because it was complete in her mind. We don't know exactly what she learned or what, but she knew what she was learning, and Montessori respected that, and respected the fact that young children know what they need to learn and can learn a great deal if we sort of create the environment. Obviously, and there are many things that we have to teach young children. You don't run on the street, you don't need things from the floor. Obviously there, but there's a lot that could come from children, and so it's so important to look at what children are learning and what they need to learn. Interesting, in a study of people who attained eminence before the age of 40, if you look at their childhood, the parents watch what they did. The child liked to play music, they allowed the child to play music. If the child showed them interest in art, they gave the child art supplies. They just supported the child's own interest rather than trying to Midori, violinist who was here on, I guess grew up here in Long Island, was fortunately taken to a music teacher who was very skilled. She said, don't give her lessons, you'll destroy her. You know, she let her find out her own way first, and then we can, because she has such great talent. And the other thing that parents often say is, well, you know, look at Tiger Woods. You know, he started playing golf at three, and look at him now. He said, so my kid starts early, and so on. Tiger Woods is a genius, kind of Mozart of golf. I mean, he picked up a golf club at two or something, was playing. It reminds me of a story about Mozart. Someone, a young aspiring composer, once asked Mozart, teach me to write a symphony. And Mozart said, well, you know, symphony is a very complex construction. Maybe you ought to start with something more simple, like an etude. And the aspiring composer said, and he got upset. He said, Mozart, you wrote a symphony when you were eight. And the aspiring Mozart said, yes, that's true. But I didn't have to ask how. We can't create genius. Genius is there, and it's wonderful, and those people who are talented have it, and just music flows through their heads and so on. But we can't create that. We can't teach that, and so we can't teach children to be Tiger Woods. We can't teach them to be Mozarts. Talent is a gift, and some people are gifted, others are not. We're all gifted in one way or another. But the idea that somehow, because we can't take the exception as the rule, that's the problem. Mozart is an exception. Tiger Woods an exception. We shouldn't take those exceptions as the rule for all children. Doesn't make sense. And we just know from all our knowledge about child growth and development that this early pushing doesn't really work. What have I been going on? Talk a little bit about what we as parents and educators can do now. We can't turn the clock back, we can't go back, and certainly there are many wonderful things that come as a result of technology and our digital world. As I say, you know, there are many things that children can learn from television, and there are many opportunities and occupations that are now created that weren't there before that children can follow in terms of computers and media and all those things. So there are many, and I think that as well that education will change as a result of computers. Revolutions come about either through ideas or through technology. Many people have tried to reform education through ideas, and there have been at least 40 different educational reform movements with different ideas, and none of them have worked. But I think technology will change education. As computers move into the schools increasingly, they give children a chance to become more involved in their own learning. I think there's a new educational reality. Knowledge was once the province of people like myself, professors and teachers and so on, but we no longer, as teachers and professors and so on, have a monopoly on knowledge. Google may, but we don't. And so knowledge is much more available to everybody, and much more, and children can get to, and books are on, and textbooks on their way out, really. They're now already outmoded. Most of them have already context to the web, and they have CDs and so on. And increasingly, they have to be redone each year or something to keep sales up and so on. It's getting to be more and more, I think textbooks will be pretty much out of date. And much of the kind of education that we traditionally know will probably change as well. Hopefully that in many of the schools where computers are used in very creative ways, children can use them to make podcasts and do research and so on, and become partners, teachers become, rather than, you know, exposers of knowledge and so on, to consultants and helpmates with children to discover their world and so on. So education is going to change, and it already is changing dramatically. Certainly at the university level, many of our graduate students are already teaching us as faculty how to use computers and all the programs, and they're much more skilled in many of these things than we are. And there's so many ways to access information. And Phoenix University, which is university online, is becoming more and more. There are 400,000 people online, and many, many universities now have online programs and so on. So the whole notion of education, way of educating, is changing, is going to change dramatically. I think to the extent that it involves young children in a more active way, then it'll involve much more like work, love, and play, because children, once they're involved in it themselves, they enjoy it much more. And that's really one of the I think, tragedies of this No Child Left Behind program, was by making teachers teach to the curriculum and teach to the test, and kills their creativity. Many teachers, when they involved children in playing games and so on, the learning was much better because they had brought the play aspect in, and that made the love aspect, because children enjoy it and so on, and they learn better. So when you have play and learning, it's much more effective. But when you're just teaching to the test, it's dull and dreary, and hard on teachers, hard on kids, and isn't very effective. So again, but I think hopefully when computers come widely into our schools, and new generations of teachers are more proficient with them, we'll see a change in the way in which education is done. But in the meantime, there are things that we can do, and particularly for young children, I think it's so important to make sure that children have time with the real world, that they understand nature, that they go out for walks, and even in Central Park and so on, that they see the real world and real animals and real kind of things. Certainly the virtual world's important and so on, but children need to learn the real world before they learn the virtual world. So they really need to experience it directly. Many years ago, I was asked to consult on a case of a young girl who was in California, who was found, her mother had brought her to a social work agency. Her mother was applying for some support. She was going blind, and so she brought this daughter with her, and an alert social worker recognized that this child was strange, and sent somebody to visit them in their home in a suburb of Los Angeles, and they found that this girl had been kept in a room for all of her life, 13 years, in a small room, 14 by 12, with just one window with a dirty cafe curtain. There was just a bed in it, and a potted chair, and a broken television, and magazines with pictures cut out. And she lived in this room for all of her life. Her father had thought she was retarded, didn't want to give her to social work agency, so he kept her there. He committed suicide certainly after she was found. I was asked to evaluate her intellectually, and I was in California, and I was in the East Coast. I packed all my gear, Wexler, and all my tests. And then when I saw Jeannie, she was staying, and they called Jeannie, not her real name, it's the name that they gave her, and there have been books and television programs made about her. When I first saw her at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, she was at the 1 percentile with respect to height and weight. She stooped over when she walked. She could not speak very much. She's something like, don't do that. She had permanent calluses on her bum because she had been tied to a potty chair for hours on end. She could not eat solid food. She had been only given sort of gruel like oatmeal and so on. So immediately that I saw her, I recognized that I couldn't give her any psychological test. And I followed her. I went with her about the ward for a couple of days and said what she did. And I could tell that she would put something in a drawer and take it out again. So I know that she had what Piaget called object permanence. She recognized that things continue to exist even when they were out of her sight, which is sort of children get that about a year of age. And she had some beginning notions of causality after a while. After she got accustomed to the elevator, she could push the buttons and so on. One of the most interesting experiences, the psychologist on the ward was a friend, and that's why he invited me to do the psychological evaluation. We took her out to Griffith Park, which is a lovely park in the Hollywood Hills just outside of the hospital. And she had never, of course, been out before, and so the world was all so new to her. She would hear the birds sing, and she'd look, and she went down to touch the grass, and students were having a picnic, and they recognized that she was an odd-looking child, and one of them gave her an orange, and she didn't know what to do with it. She looked at it, she smelled it, And I peeled it for her when it was California oranges. And she still didn't know. And I offered her a slice, but she wouldn't. So I took it and made her smile and so on. So she finally took a bite, and then the juice dripped down and had this glorious sort of smile on her face. She'd never tasted an orange before. And so the whole, she just, all this stimulation coming at her. And on the way back, we stopped at a little convenience store to get her an ice cream. And there was a little rack there with cellophane packages of nuts and candy and some spices and so on. And she would listen and smell. And she just couldn't get enough experience, you know. And as we were getting into the car, door barked, and she was scared. And the point I'm making is that here is a girl who has not experienced the world and who needed to experience it, needed to hear it and taste it and feel it and smell it before she could begin to conceptualize it. Unfortunately, at the time she was discovered, there was a big controversy in Harvard, between Harvard and MIT, with Noam Chomsky at MIT, saying that language is innate that we had an innate language learning device. And Skinner saying that language had learned, so they thought Genie would be a wonderful way to test this theory, who was right. If we could teach her language, then obviously Skinner was right. If she couldn't, then obviously Chomsky was right, because it was innate and she hadn't been a chance to learn it. Anyway, they gave her to some linguist and so on to stay with and so on. And it failed miserably, and it's a long, long story, but after many, many years of trying and so on and bouncing around, she finally now is living in a home outside of Los Angeles and never made much progress. We don't know whether she was retarded or whether it was lack of experience and so on. But the point is, when I argued and nobody listened to me, I said, don't go into language yet. Let her learn about the world. Let her get those experiences. Then she can. But language doesn't mean anything unless she has the concepts to fit it to, you know. Red doesn't, blue doesn't mean anything if you can't see red, you can't see blue. The point, again, I want to make is that how important the real world is to young children, and how important it is for them to explore it, and how important it is for them to conceptualize it and not to mush too quickly into the virtual world, into even the symbolic world, before children have experience of the real one. We don't have a lot of we have a lot of misunderstandings of what is good for children and what I think there are really two basic things that children need, one of those is the sense that they're important in our lives and we care about them deeply, and I think that's really critical. We talk a lot about quality time. I don't know what quality time is. And I'm not sure it's an issue of time. My parents were immigrants, there were six children. I was the youngest. My father was a machinist in Detroit. And he worked, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. I never played ball with him, went fishing with him, didn't do all the go to movies, all day. Never did any of those things. That was my father. Sundays, he was tired, he often slept. When we had time, he would teach me to use tools. We often took a week vacation, but that was the only time we relaxed. My mother with six children, and we had, just a three-bedroom apartment, and I slept in the living room, and because the apartment was so small, the kitchen will hold only two people at a time, so we had to eat in shifts. We had a little dining room in the apartment, but we never used that except on the holidays. I don't understand why we did that, but it was reserved for the holidays. But my brothers and sisters and I loved my parents greatly, respected them deeply, and I think what we recognized, not immediately, of course, but was that they had sacrificed for us, my father worked very hard to give us a better life. He was a very honest, very religious, man who cared deeply about us, and wanted to give us a better life, and thought never occurred to him that we owed him anything, or we needed to give him something back. And the same with my mother, except when we got older, she did expect us to call more often. Anyway, but other than that, the And I think what they gave us was a sense that we were important in their lives, and they cared about us deeply. And we had that feeling that really can deal with a lot of other things. That's what self-esteem is really all about. Self-esteem is really about feeling that somebody, you're important in somebody's life, and they care about you deeply. Of course, today we can't sacrifice in the way that we did in an earlier time, but we can do things, give up things, to put meeting or something else to be with our children. I think it's so important to take, if we have more than one child, take each child separately on trips, or even to shopping or something, or for a meal or a birthday, so we get to know them individually, and that gives them the feeling that they're important in our lives. We care enough about them, and getting children gifts, really thinking about the kind of children they are, what their personalities are, what their real likes and interests are, not the, you know, because it's an expensive gift or whatever, but something that really reflects the fact that we took the time to know who that child is and to give them something that they would really value. Those are the things that give children the feeling that they're important in our lives. And it may not be a matter of time so much as how we use that time and how we communicate to them how important they are. The other most difficult thing, I guess, for us to parent is to allow children to be the best that they can be and not what we want them to be. At Tufts, we have students, freshmen assigned to us every 4 years, and we respect to be those students' advisors through the 4 years. So obviously some change, so they change majors and so on, but some stay with us for 4 years. And it's a wonderful experience because you get to see how children change through, young people change those years. They become so much more mature. We think about growing up, but those 4 years can be remarkable in terms of the growth. And it's nice for someone to be able to witness that change and reflect it back to those young people. And I had one girl who was a really wonderful student, she came to me, she was graduating, and asked me to write a letter of recommendation for her to law school. And I said, it'd be my pleasure. You've been a great student and a wonderful young woman. And I love the, you know, you've just matured so much since you just came. I really am so, so proud of you. And she broke into tears. And she said, I really don't want to go to law school. She said, my passion is art. I love to draw and paint. I want to go to art school. But my parents, really, they want me to go to law school. They've worked hard, very hard to pay for the schools and make me go, and I can't disappoint them. I've talked to them, but they want me to, and I felt so sorry for this girl that she had to, do something that was against, what she really wanted to do. And I understand the parents' desire and so on, but it's so important, I think, for us as parents to try and help children to be the best that they can be. I've seen so many parents of our students, a student who's a B student, a good B student, works hard, he's a B student. I mean, we're very, and instead of rewarding that child for being a good B student, being the best B student that he or she can be, apparently he gets put down because he's not an A student. And so I think that's the hardest thing for us to do, is to accept children for what they are. Children are different, all children are different in the same family, and they have their own trajectories, and we have to be supportive of that and recognize that we have to help them to be the best that they can be and not what we want them to be. And that's very hard to do. I'll give you another example. I have three sons, and the middle son is always, middle children are always a little difficult. They're not the youngest, not the oldest. So they, again, that whole issue of trying to be two things at once, how can you be the oldest and the youngest? You're not the oldest, not the youngest. And it's always a struggle, and middle children tend to be a little bit more obstreperous and rebellious and so on. He was gifted mathematically, and he, 11th grade in high school, he decided he was going to drop out of school. And he wasn't into drugs or any of that stuff. He played in a band he was very frustrated because he was very good at math, and he would always come to answers in his own way. He got the right answers, but the teacher wouldn't give him credit because he didn't go through it the way he was supposed to go through it. So he got frustrated, and he decided he was going to leave. And so I got very upset. But my wife, who's a better psychologist than I, said, he's a good kid. He's not doing bad stuff. We have to support him. And if he decides to go back to school, we'll support him to go back to college with like his brother. So we did. And he drove a cab for a while and worked as a waiter and played with a band and traveled around and then decided it wasn't for him. And so he got a job part-time with Genzyme, a biotech firm in Boston, and pretty soon sort of began to change it because his computer was very good with computers. And, you know, pretty soon the earrings came out and the baggy pants came out and he wore a shirt and tie. Eventually decided to go full-time at Genzyme, and they sent him to school. He didn't want to go to school full-time, and they went part-time, graduated with his BA, and then went on to work with EMC Squared, and they sent him to graduate school. So he got his graduate degree in computer science, and now is doing the security for a major firm. Anyway, he had to do it in his own way, and he... But every child, his two brothers went through straight arrow, you know, and didn't have anything. And it's a very hard call, you know. I was ready to read them out and to whether to support kids, but I think that's one of the things we have to do. And I think we have a lot of long-wrong intuitions about children and about the world. We believe the Earth was flat, and we discovered it was round through disappearance of ships in the horizon, shadow of the Earth and the Moon, and so on. We believe that the Sun revolved around the Earth, and we eventually discovered that wasn't true. And there are a lot of psychological intuitions that are incorrect. We believe that because opposites attract, they should bind, but opposites attract, but they often don't bind. And with respect to children, often we tend to think that children, their children are most like us in their thoughts and least like us in their feelings. In fact, just the opposite is true. Children are most like us in their feelings, least like us in their thoughts. And that's why it's so important for us to say please and thank you and excuse to me, children, because children are, you know, feel the same way we do when we break a promise, we don't do things that we said we're going to do, or we make a bad remark or something. And that's why it's so important. But it's an intuition, and we act on it. And unfortunately, another intuition that we have is that the best preparation for a bad experience is a bad experience. So if you're going to have a bad experience later on, you better have it early on. And so we now have a whole bibliotherapy for young children on AIDS and homosexuality and divorce and all of these things, because you might as well learn about that now because you're going to learn about it later and so on. And even teaching it in schools, one child was learning about AIDS at school, second grader, went home, told his mother he knew all about AIDS. She said, "You learn all about AIDS." "I know all about AIDS." "You learn all about, I know all about AIDS. What do you know?" "I know all about AIDS. What do you know?" "I know all about, what do you know?" Well, don't have intersections and buy condominiums. Kids not so, and the truth is that the best preparation for a bad experience is a good experience. And when we give children all those experiences, it helps them to feel that they're important in our lives, we care about them deeply. When we allow them to be the best that we can be and support them, then we give them all those wonderful good experiences that give them both the roots and the wings that allow them the best that they can be and to deal most effectively with any bad experiences that they'll have later. Thank you all. Yeah, I'll take a few questions.
We have time for a few questions, if you have any questions you'd like to ask.
Yes. Well, that's why I was talking about play, love, and work. I think what people need to be, to be happy and is to in their lives to adult to be able to integrate play, love, and work. And the people who really enjoy what they do, as I told my sons, you know, I don't care. You know, I want you to be happy with the kinds of things that you're doing. If you hate going to work every day, then it's not worth it. So it means sort of finding something that you really enjoy, and that it isn't a chore to do. So that work becomes part of play, and then you love that too. And so bringing work, love, and play together, I think, are what the ideal forms that we need to do in for our kids. And too often when we force them into the, you know, going to schools, that they all these things, it really troubles me that we don't allow children to really follow their passions in high school, that they're so busy doing all that stuff. But what's the point? Life is short. It's very short. And when you look back at it, it's like a dream. And we get too influenced by why other people are thinking, what other people care about, and so on. We have to look at what's important for us, what's really important in our lives, and to not think. I think one of the problems with media and social media is we begin to be too important, too involved with what other people think and other people concerned. And we have to decide. And I didn't get a chance to talk about the whole fact that we're so inundated with material. We don't have time to reflect now. We don't have time to find our inner selves because we're so bombarded with things constantly, and that's why media becomes so powerful. We don't have time to reflect upon what our real thoughts are, what our real feelings are, what's really important to us. And I think that's so important that you have to, I look at my children now, and they grew up so fast. But fortunately, we did take time to enjoy life, and those times that I took each of them with a trip when we traveled, and those are still the times that we remember the most. We took those special trips on or together. So I think bringing together play, love, and work is the important thing. And I think sometimes we just have to say what's good for us and don't worry about what the rest of the world is saying. Yes. Yeah, I don't think there's really much. A good early childhood education program, which has those things, give children really all that they need, and it's a half-day program. Children get the kind of socialization skills and things. And then, doing things, having the right toys. A good set of blocks is one of the best set of toys children and parents can get for kids, and things that allow room for their imagination and so on. I'm always impressed with my grandchildren when they're alone. They do so many. The play is so natural to children. They can keep busy by themselves, making all kinds of things. My granddaughter came to visit us, and when we had a little place. They live in Hawaii, and she just found newspapers, and she was folding them and tying them with scotch tape, and folding, and just kept doing it. Had a great time. So children, if left to their own devices, will learn all kinds, and they learn all kinds of things. I don't think children need lessons before the age of 4 or 5. It really doesn't make a lot of sense. And there's so many other things that they can learn. There's plenty of time for lessons. Yes. Well, I think there are a couple of things. One thing I have mentioned, there are a group of us now who are looking at students in major universities like MIT, Harvard, Stanford, Dufts, and so on, and we're finding that the students are less imaginative, less creative than they were, and that's a real concern now because we're going to be competitive in a global community, and these are our best universities, and our students are, and it's partly because they haven't played as children. For parents, it is very difficult, and one of the things I suggest is that there be a balance, that if you're going to be on the computer for an hour, then you play with your friends, or you play outside for an hour, or so on. And sometimes, you know, you have to do things which make you that your kids aren't going to be happy with. And you say, look, because I know a lot of my students who say their parents didn't let them watch television and so on, are often the kids who read the best or most initiative and so on. And sometimes we have to take the flack of kids now and recognize that they'll appreciate it later. They don't understand that. But if we make the effort, because they can, I think kids can deal with it. But it's harder on us because we have to, you know, deal with it. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yes.
Want to address the issue of when your son dropped out of high school. I have a question. I'm sure it was very traumatic for you and your wife. During this time because I have a child going through the same thing, during this time, all these years that it took him to reach the point is now, were you and your wife always supportive? Did you ever say, gee, that was a mistake, or gee, don't you want to think about going back to school now? Or did you just support him even when you knew he wasn't making a good choice?
We tried to provide guidance. I tried to get him to go back to school, and he went, but it wasn't very successful, so we gave it up. I think that my youngest son graduated Tufts and was thinking about going to law school, but he was also in karate class, and he was thinking about starting his own school, and my wife said again, you know, go see. So I saw what he was doing in the school, and he was very good with all these stuff. I hadn't seen him do these things, and he was teaching children. And so I said, well, you know, we decided if this is really what you want to do, this is really going to make you happy, then this is what you should do, and we'll give the money that we were going to support you for law school to go there. And he waited a year and decided to go to law school. But you know, it's a hard choice, and I think you have to try to. Fortunately, my kids were not in any stuff. They for some reason they got into martial arts, and that kept them out of the whole drug, all that kind of scene. And they, it's a very hard call. And I think that you can sometimes suggest it, but it really has to be their decision. They have to learn their own way, and we can't. You know, after a certain point, we can't live their lives for them, and they have to make those choices and make the mistakes that they can learn from. And hopefully, we've given them the kind of support that they need. And then, you know, you can always, we always said, you know, if you want to go back to school, you can go back. I think the important thing is not to cut bridges, not to say, okay, you don't do it now. You know, it's like with children taking lessons. We get this idea that somehow, if you signed up for it, you made a commitment, you got to stay. Otherwise, you don't keep a commitment, you'll be a bump, you know. So you got to stick with it, even though you hate it. And the point is that there's no transfer of training. If a child doesn't stay, you know, there's no transfer of training between, you know, if you stop a thing and drop it and other things. I think children need to experiment, and if you know, but you say, okay, you don't want to take music lessons now, it'll be open. You want us to take them a little later, we'll do it then. But you have to give it a good shot, but if it doesn't work, you know. Yes, I'm sorry. It's a good question about whether all the visual stuff how it affects ADD. We don't have any direct evidence, clearly, but there's always this issue: is it better diagnosis or is it, you know? And I have to think it's a little bit of the thing. I have to believe that children who are too concentrated on television, as I say, they become visually addicted and so on, and that can, because television is episodic and so on, can affect their attentional abilities. I mean, we don't have hard, fast evidence, but certainly the increase in children with ADHD. associated with the increase in television viewing and a lot of the other things that are sort of certainly can contribute. And on the other hand, I also see too many children who are misdiagnosed and misdiagnosed too early. So we have to be careful about that too. It becomes a convenient diagnosis often when I had a case of a 13-year-old who was moved, parents divorced, she moved to Chicago, her grandmother died, which she was very close to, and she had all these symptoms, and they immediately diagnosed her as ADHD, but it didn't have to do with all the stress she was experiencing from other domains. So we have to be careful about overdiagnosis of ADHD, but I do believe that, given all the evidence we have, that certainly new, the media, and certainly television viewing particularly, can contribute to ADHD. You know, it may be a predisposition, like asthma. If you have asthma and you have predisposition, if you grow up in Arizona, you may never develop asthma. If you grow up in Boston, you certainly will. And so, again, if you have a predisposition to these kinds of things and you're overexposed to a particular kind of stimuli, it may precipitate a condition that wouldn't have been precipitated otherwise. I'm sorry? It depends. It depends on, you know, on the child. It's hard to know, but because everything, you know, many children are impatient because they want things right away and they don't have a good sense of time, so they don't know, you know, a week, a month, they don't have a good time sense, and so that's where often the impatience come from, is lack of understanding of time, and they want it right away. I don't know how much time we have.
One more question.
Okay. We don't really have good evidence. Interesting about sweetening in children's. The reason that baby food was sweetened was not because babies wanted it, but because mothers tasted it and it tasted bland, and they wanted to add something to it. But we don't. There is certainly evidence that sugar does could create, and you know. I'm sorry. Well, it's complicated. Certainly, sugar contributes to activity, but there are other aspects. There are so many other things that are going on in children's lives that, whether it's stress from one thing or another, just the kind of content of what they're seeing, there could be many other things that are, I hate going into a lot of restaurants now. The music is so loud and blaring. I get jittery just from listening to it, and I don't know how people can eat to that music. But anyway, so there are many other things in our environment which can lead to kind of this kind of excitement and activity. Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Elkind. Thank you for coming today. Please, if you didn't fill out a sheet to be on our mailing list, please fill that out. If you have any survey forms, please hand those in. And please keep coming to the library. Thank you again.